Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. Hey, welcome to our show in episode 476, as we share the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her friendships. All 200 hours. Yes, I bet you remember that rule. We're going to be hearing more. This is a really special show, and I know that it'll touch you deeply, big time. Girlfriends. Before we begin, please know that this episode is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y. Vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature. They've got a real special gift for women, the new award-winning Her Life Stages products providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. It's an integrative, holistic approach to having a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about her life stages, run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Solaray.com. Man, I'm telling you, if you go to Solaray.com, make sure to use promo code HER20 for 20% off. You'll be glad you did. And here's your first reminder to click on iTunes after the episode to rate and review today's show, because the entire Her Podcast team just loves your feedback. You'll get another reminder. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Friendships, girlfriends. Don't people say that we tend and befriend and, you know, all of this craziness about women and our bonding together back and forth? Okay, well, that's all special. And I actually studied some of this at my lab at the National Institutes of Health, a little oxytocin moment. And we were pretty convinced that it's easy to make friends and hang out and do your thing until the 21st century. And then things got a little more complicated. It's called devices. Do you ever look up? Do you ever make eye contact? Do you actually meet up in a cafe and hang out? What do you do out there? It's like crazy time now. And I think the only person we can pivot to make any sense of this is Dr. Jeffrey Hall. Now, many of you have read so much about his work. It's been published in just about every single one of our newspapers. I read about him all the time in the Wall Street Journal, as you're going to hear in a second. And Dr. Hall is at the University of Kansas, and he's a professor of communication studies. Thank God for communication studies is all I can say. And a visiting scholar at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law. He has a multitude of awards and accomplishments. But the most important thing, the most important thing was that everybody remembered his study. A study he's going to tell you about. All about how long it takes to really make a BFF, a best friend forever. Jeff, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So he also has books. He wrote a book in 2013 called The Five Flirting Styles. Use the Science of Flirting to Attract the Love You Really Want. Damn, I wish I had read that. Just kidding. My husband listening, and then Relating Through Technology, Advances in Personal Relationships. This was 2022. And then I'm so excited that there's a forthcoming book that I'm going to have Jeff explain to the world, which will be coming out in January. And I just cannot wait. So this is all extremely timely, especially in an era where friendships are, well, I don't know, are we all divided out there? Is this turning into a nightmare or what are we doing here? So Jeff, tell us first, how did you get so involved with this whole issue of friendships as an academic pursuit?
The very first opportunity I had to study friendship was actually when I got to teach interpersonal communication at the University of Southern California. And this was a long time ago, about 20 years ago. And one of the things I was really interested in and wanted to study more was the idea that there were sex differences in friendship between men and women. So it was a topic that had been talked about a lot. And one of the things that was strange was that I was running into this kind of pattern where you would see that, as you mentioned before, you know, the friend and befriend concept of how women bond with one another and relate to each other, higher levels of intimacy. But also women were more likely to be disappointed with their friends or frustrated with their friends in ways that seemed to be a little bit counterintuitive. So my project was on this idea that we actually have expectations for our friends, and that men and women differ in what they expect from their friends. So the benefit that women get out of expecting more out of their friends is that they tend to have more intimate friendships, more strongly bonded friendships, offer more support. But they're more likely to be disappointed with their friends actually not living up to those expectations because they're so high. Men, on the other hand, tend to have friendships which expect less, but they also tend to be disappointed less often. So they actually get less out of their friendships, but they're also not expecting much to begin with. So my whole ideas about friendship began in the process of trying to untangle this idea that we cultivate a certain level of complexity in our friendships with one another, and that we get kind of what we expect, but we also, based on our expectations, might be sorely disappointed if our friend can't live up to the things that we expect of them.
Huh. Well, thank God for people like you is all I can say, because the rest of us are out here just stumbling around in the darkness, blind leading the blind, trying to figure out, like, how do you do this whole friend thing? So when you first published that study, what was it, 2018?
The Friendship Hours Project. Yeah, that's right. 2018.
Yeah. And I remember reading about it, glomming onto it, immediately sitting back going, oh, am I doing this right? I had just met a couple new people and I'm like, oh, I got to start racking up some hours here. I'm not going to be a good friend. And then you ask yourself, what are quality hours? And that's kind of interesting. And you also said there's a 50-hour rule too, isn't there?
That's right. I think that the paper got as much attention as it did is that the entirety of it can really be summarized in three numbers, right? 50, 90, 200. And the 50-hour idea was that between 40 and 60 hours, people transition between an acquaintance to a casual friendship. Between 80 and 100 hours, they transition between a casual friendship to a friend. And then after roughly about 100 or 200 hours, excuse me, they actually move into very close or best friend territory. These are hours that you already get from the levels you're at before. So if, you know, two people are friends and they've already spent 100 hours together, 100 more usually gets them to the place of being a close friend or a best friend. So you're also asking the question about what are quality hours? Like, what does it really matter to be able to have higher quality? And that's one of the I think one of the big take homes of the study that people don't know if they just look at the numbers, which is that you can speed up the process of friendship development depending on how you spend the time together. So if you spend the time together hanging out, enjoying each other's company, doing things that are kind of moving away from the places that you first met, so a person you meet at work, but doing things that are outside of work, all of those things help to transition that friendship into a closer level of relationship. It's funny, I actually just saw in the New York Times, you know, Friendship Challenge this week, the idea, this is called repotting. I had never heard that before because I had always called it like a context shift, right? Which switch context to another place in which that we develop our friendship. So when we do that, we not only how we spend that time, but also what we talk about matters for speeding up the friendships. So friendships that are based on catching up, joking around, having more meaningful talk, speed more quickly through the process of friendship development.
So as we're all sort of sitting here saying, I know women, being one, and I know what you're thinking out there on her podcast land, you're going, oh man, am I doing this right? And there's a little scorekeeping going on, like, well, how many times did we go to that little Starbucks and hang out and back and forth? You know, I have found that there's all kinds of hybrids, aren't there? So I have a colleague, I'm on faculty with the Institute of Coaching at Harvard, and one of my colleagues is the co-director of that program. She and I, you know, bonded early on years ago, but she lives in Massachusetts and I don't. So when we get together, that's great. It's usually at a conference or, you know, the usual stuff. But what I have found is that we racked up a lot of hours on virtual, on phone, on text. Like, is that quality stuff? Yet, I just saw her in Boston for another board meeting. And it was like I just saw her yesterday. Literally, like, I just picked it up immediately, and she and I were just off and running, there's also an issue about the quality and the depth of the connection from the beginning, which kind of hastens the 200 hours or however, so that some people kind of like, well, it takes a while to warm up and kind of do your thing. And then other people, it's like, we're diving in and we're right there. And I could guarantee you, she and I became BFFs in maybe like less than 100 hours because we're so deep. So tell us what that's all about.
Yeah. So you're talking about, there's kind of two different things going on here. Well, on one hand, what you're saying fits nicely into, you know, 60 years of research on the idea that self-disclosure and the process of really getting in deep with people not only builds liking, but we like people we self-disclose to. And when we self-disclose to others, they tend to like us back. And so that tends to be a formula that we've known, I don't know, since the 70s about this kind of concept that why talking about ourselves, revealing things about ourselves really starts to build an intimacy more quickly. Certainly through liking. And I would also add to this that, you know, when you're talking about the idea of, you know, this kind of sense in which that two people click, it's actually one of my favorite ways to understand relational development is it's called the clicking model. And again, that one's been around for a while. And when I looked at my Friendship Hours paper and other things about context shift, I really wanted to think about this idea. It is totally possible that two people, when they meet, just click, right? They have certain ways of communicating. They have certain topics that they share. They have backgrounds or ways in which that they see each other from and see the world in a very similar way. And what that does is it allows them to have this sense of kind of like almost like synchrony, like you sync up with someone and you begin to talk in the same way and share a similar points of view. And it allows for this kind of burst of connection to happen right away. So all of those things are absolutely possible and all those things are absolutely true. The one caution that I'd mention is that it's also the case that lots and lots of people meet, click, and never do anything about it. How many times in our culture do we say, "Ah, that was great to meet you. I'd love, let's talk again." Never follow up. How many times do you have a great occasion to meet a person you meet at work or through the neighborhood or through something that you're part of? You really click with them, but you don't do anything to develop that relationship past. And I think that one of the things to keep in mind here is I'm not trying to say with the Friendship Hours argument that basically people can't have what it feels like to be deeply connected with a person immediately. Absolutely, that happens, right? And that puts us on a trajectory of connection. The difference is that people begin to really conceptualize who are my friends in my life based not on the connection that you have initially, but the repeated, sustained interactions that you have with people that basically confirm the fact that they want to continue that relationship with you. If you meet a person once and have a great conversation, but never talk to them again, almost nobody would say that was my friend. Almost no one says that is a friend of mine. It was a great moment, or I remember that great conversation, but you didn't even remember their name. Friendship requires a longevity, a cross-context familiarity, a willingness to bring that person into your life. And overwhelmingly, we don't do it. We make connections and we move on with our lives.
It's work.
Damn right.
You know, it's interesting. It's work. And I never fully appreciated that for many years. I got to say, for many years, I didn't understand, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, the amount of work it takes to be able to maintain and really establish a foundation for friendship. You know, part of it is like, if you move a lot, if you're, you know, kind of mobile, it's really hard to kind of be in one place and all the rest of it. I call it medical training. You know, after my years in undergrad, then grad, then medical school, and then residency program, then fellowship, it's like, I don't remember anybody. Just trying to get through each day and going, please, God, you know, let me pass the boards. And then after that, you kind of sit back and go, damn, do I remember anybody? Because life is that way. And I'm sure law school and engineering school, you know, all the rest of that, it's just, it's weird that way. Yet, flashing forward, what I'm now learning, and please enlighten us with your expertise, because you are just about the renowned expert on this whole issue, is that it really portends well for your health and well-being mentally, physically, because if you have long-lasting relationships and you've established that foundation, young people don't understand that after the age of 50, honey, it gets a little weird out there people start falling off cliffs, right? They disappear from your life. Just when you need the support at multiple levels and to fight that now epidemic of loneliness, let alone to have that whole interconnectedness that people need as they enter the 50s, 60s, and beyond to be able to be healthy. Now, remember the study, obviously you know more than anybody, the longevity study of the guys at Hopkins. It was basically a male study. Now they've actually added in some women and this and that, but there are also multiple other studies now that have been done on longevity. And what they found is that so much of your health and well-being is dependent upon the number of true deep friendships you have by the age of 50. I had to sit with that, like, whoa, wait a minute now. I just started counting my little friends here on my fingers. So what do you think about all that?
Wow. I mean, you've mentioned like five different things that I could totally run with. I'm trying to pick and choose which ones that I might.
Go to the health and wellness part of that. Why?
Sure.
Having friendships, deep friendships that become supportive and you put in the work and you put in the, you know, why is that so important for our health and wellness?
Got it. Yeah. There's actually a couple ways to approach this. In the book that's coming up next year, The Social Biome, we talk about why are the reasons that getting our need to belong met essentially leads to these outcomes, longevity, health, you know, well-being. And so there are three pathways, right? And one pathway I think is the most commonsensical one is that people who care about us look out for us. They look out for you. Are you taking care of yourself? You should really make sure that you're quit smoking or look out for you, or you're taking on this new sort of regimen of exercise. Good job. Keep up with it. You know, particularly close relationship partners or people who visit you in the hospital, they make sure that you're okay. They're concerned for your well-being. So one pathway is maybe the most obvious one, which is that fundamentally, if you have people in your life who care about you, they're checking in to make sure that you're not making bad choices and you're making more good choices. The second one, I think, is actually a little more mysterious because we don't see it. The other one, and this one is the one I think has gained a lot of traction with researchers around both long-term and short-term stress. So the short-term model of stress says that essentially we re-regulate our stress response when we feel nurtured and cared for. So this is both true if you have a strong attachment, a strong relationship, but also someone in the moment saying supportive and kind things. What's fascinating is, you know, some researchers in communication have just found that affectionate words or actions or hugs or kisses just for that moment reduces your stress response. So it not only buffers us from having a strong stress response to stressors, but it also improves our recovery time more speedily. This also matters in the long term. Chronic stress, chronic sort of the toll of just living and going through work and all the different things we have to deal with in our lives, having strong relational partners tends to also improve our stress response for chronic stress conditions. So one of the ones interesting about this kind of thing is this is actually even be found at the telomere level, right? This happens, you know, sort of on our DNA level of how we express our genes depends on our stressors. And when we have loving and caring relationships, including friendships in there, we actually benefit by that. But the last one that I think is actually maybe the most specific to friendship, because you can imagine the first two very much being about parents and your romantic partners and stuff, is it improves the quality of the things that are already good. Having company to do good things makes you feel better. Having someone to enjoy the things you love in life makes you feel better. It makes you feel like your life is more meaningful and satisfying to share experiences with people who care about you. And you can definitely do that with your family and your romantic partners. But friends are unique because they see your identity for who you are and want to be with you because of who you are. They say, you, out of all the people that I've met, are worth spending time with. You are worth catching up with. You are worth sharing my life struggles with. You're worth confiding in. And I think that we can think about the health-related benefits as being things which are very sort of medicalized around stress, but we can also think the thriving-related benefits about what it means to kind of live a full and complete life. And it is my kind of hunch that friendship really plays a gargantuan role in that process of thriving in life, because that it makes everything just that much better.
Oh, you know, I'm just saying, you're definitely in the hot spot here, because of all times in history, in our social cultural history, to be talking about this. Because, well, let's go back to a Wall Street Journal article that came out in January of this year. That's 2024. And you were obviously quoted as the expert in it. And what was said was very interesting. As we trek further into adulthood, I'm reading from the article, many of our friends fall away. You know, it's understandable. You move and back and forth. About 88% of U.S. adults said they have lost touch with a close friend at some point. 71% would like to rekindle that relationship, according to a 2020 survey. And 4 in 10 Americans said they didn't have a best friend at all. Whoa, 4 in 10 Americans said they didn't have a best friend at all, up from 25% in 1990. And this is a poll from 2021 by the Survey Center on American Life. This is kind of wild. Does any of that surprise you?
Well, given the fact that we've been noticing increasing rates of loneliness, you know, being reported by people for a while, that would work out through our relationships with other people, particular friends, makes sense, right? I mean, loneliness really is a product of not having the kind of opportunities to socialize or the closeness of relationships that you would like to have. So it's not an objective thing where you can say, I have 2 friends, therefore I'm not lonely, or my romantic relationship is this good, therefore I'm not lonely. It's really the difference between what you want, what your expectations are of your relationships, and your opportunities to socialize and what you have. So in some sense, we have been people have been telling us for a while that they are feeling more lonely, they're feeling more disconnected. And another thing which is interesting is where that is localized. It happens in 2 major stages of life. One is amongst young folks in the United States. A lot of really fascinating analyses by terrific scholars like Patricia Hockley from the University of Chicago and Julianne Holt-Lundstad, who have done this kind of work, really suggests that it's possible that the major increases of loneliness we've seen in the last 20 years are centralized around the under 30 crowd, that they are experiencing comparatively higher rates of loneliness now than they have in the past. But the other thing to keep in mind is that older adulthood, usually folks who are post 75 or so, and then younger adulthood are the 2 high peaks of loneliness. So you go through this period of life where you have high loneliness in your youth, it declines throughout your middle age years, and then it goes back up at the end, towards the end of life. But what's interesting is it doesn't look like older adults' loneliness have increased. It looks like older adults' loneliness have stayed relatively stable, even though it's higher than it usually is in other parts of your life. So the question that we've really have to been struggling with is, why are young folks lonely? What's going on in our people's lives, or what's happening that leads to all this? And one of the things that I found really fascinating is I think that there are some massive institutional constraints that are making it harder and harder for young people to be able to prioritize their relationships. They need to go to college longer. They need to take on longer amounts of period of education in order to be competitive in the workplace. And all of those years put off the amount of time that they have to be able to develop more sort of stable relationships. The average age for first marriage has now increased to past 30 for men and is 29 for women, up 8 years than it was just 30 years ago. Number of people who are choosing either not to have kids or not, you know, they're having kids later or they're not having kids at all. There are people who are not having a romantic relationship. All of those things are happening. At the same time, this is putting more and more pressure on their ability to maintain their friendships. But as you say, in your testimony of being a medical profession, you move from place to place, you take job to job, you're working remotely. These are all very much characteristic of what it is like to be a millennial and to be a Gen Z. They are in a period of their life where the turmoil and the expectations of them moving on for their jobs and otherwise is so high. And all of those institutional possibilities for alleviating loneliness are being forestalled further and further into the future, putting all this weight on friendship, which can't sustain it because they don't have the time to keep their friends and to keep in touch with their friends. They report across the board saying things like, I wish I had more time with my friends. I wish that I had prioritized it. I wish my friends had prioritized me. But they're also hit by very meaningful life barriers, making it harder to prioritize friendship. So one of the things that I do on these kind of radio shows, you know, or whether I'm on television or whether I'm on podcast or whether I'm a newspaper is I feel like I'm a friendship evangelist. I'm like, we have to prioritize our friendships. We have to make it a priority in our lives. Because the truth is, if you don't make friends when you're in your 20s and 30s, the chances of having those strong lifetime friends at 50 are gone. You can't have a lifetime of friendship if a person hasn't been your friend for your lifetime. So what's hard is it's hard for us to see what we miss out on by not prioritizing friendship now.
Amen. You know, I feel like I'm under a tent. You're up there at the lectern doing the, let's do this. I gotta say, I am a textbook example of exactly what you're saying, because I've had accumulated probably with all my fellowship and blah, 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 20 years of education. Would not want that, you know, on anybody, but 20 years. Now, when the hell was I supposed to be making some kind of a meaningful friendship with anybody? But I did somehow. So I clicked with someone. I'm going to mention her name because she's fascinating. So currently, Dr. Kay Kirkpatrick is the state senator for Georgia. Poor thing, just when she wanted to retire from 40 years as an orthopedic surgeon, she gets dumped with that. So there we have it. I met her when we were both leaders in the American Medical Student Association. That's how I spent my time. And we clicked. It was like, I get it with you. Yeah, you get it with me. You know, we thought the same. Flash forward now, it's been 40 years. So I have a solid one. And you know, you said something so important. And that was, you have history with people. And so when I'm hanging out with Kay, whether I'm texting or, you know, whatever the hell we're doing, when I'm hanging out with her, I don't have to say a word. She gets it. I don't have to say, well, let me tell you about my history so you fully understand where I'm going. She's like, oh, shut up. Get it. I'm there. And it's so comforting, and it relieves you of duty, the burden of having to start all over, because she knows. And that takes, to your point, years and a long time of wild and crazy adventures together and this and that, even if it's once a year. And then the rest of it may be a little bit more remote. But to this day, I'm blessed by having her in my life. And I never fully appreciated that. And frankly, neither did she. Interestingly, we talked about this because I, you know, I slapped that 200 rule on her. And she said, honey, we did that like the first year. I mean, hey, come on now. You know, we're done.
You're well past that. Well past.
But you see where I'm coming from? It's like just to be known and to be understood. You know, you get that from families, not always, but you should. One would imagine if you've hung around long enough with your family, somebody in there must understand you a little bit. But when it comes to friends, you have to actually provide that information, that history, and then you have to have shared adventures so that, you know, it all becomes kind of clear. And then all of a sudden you have this little, this small group of people who just care about you unconditionally. You can look like crap, they love you. Sort of like my German Shepherd just looks at me in the morning and says, you know, I love you. It's a little scary right now, but I do love you. BFFs do that. They see through it all. Friendship is so, you know, when you unpack friendship, as you've done so beautifully in your research studies, your books, there's so many layers to this. Does that make sense, Jeff?
Absolutely. One of the things you've mentioned here is that the degree to which that we want to feel known and we want to feel understood. But I would also add that there is a reciprocal obligation. You know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about in the Social Biome book is we really kind of lean into this idea that we have to acknowledge that we only get to have the reciprocity of care and concern and understanding and knowledge that a friendship offers if we give that in return. We cannot just expect our friends to understand us, know us, get us, accept us, if we do not practice the process of understanding, getting, knowing another person, if we don't listen, if we don't pay attention, if we don't keep in touch, if we don't prioritize them. And I think what's really interesting is I've been very careful about trying to say, push back a little bit, as I've seen this sort of percolation of conversations in our culture that have suggested that we need to cut out our toxic friends and we need to get rid of these people who are harming our whatever. And I always want to come back to that. And I say, well, where is our obligation to our friends who are going through a hard time? Maybe the reason that our friend is obsessed with talking about themselves right now is because they're really struggling. You know, maybe the reason that they're not able to kind of get over their own hiccups or their, you know, problems or little things that they're dealing with is because that they need someone to listen and see them. And maybe we can provide that. What's really beautiful about that process, what I think is really touching in a kind of a fundamental, meaningful way, is it's in seeing other people that we provide sort of a way in which that we're seeing ourselves. We are seen through the process of giving. We are understood through the process of understanding. And I find this really gorgeous and beautiful about friendships because it calls us to have that obligation and accept that obligation to one another. So in some sense, like I think there's absolutely cases in which that people have toxic friends, right? There's definitely cases where it's massively imbalanced, like the amount of reciprocity is just not there. But on the other hand, I'm also thinking that we need to have a counter discourse in our culture that says, really, we only get the really great benefits of friendship if we provide them for another person. So it's always be reminded that we can only have that sense of being known by knowing others.
You know, it's interesting, as I'm listening to you, you look at your time every day, and it's about prioritizing. So I actually have, and really, I'm not kidding you. I'm not like, you know, giving you the big strokes here, although I am. You know, I literally do a friendship priority every day. And I say to myself, even if it's a text, if it's a voicemail, if it's, you know, however the hell, you know, I'm getting a hold of somebody, it could be LinkedIn, it could be, you know, whatever. I just want to let someone know I care and I'm there. And that I haven't heard from them for a little bit, and my apologies for maybe, you know, my travels and da-da-da and back and forth. It's almost like everyone knows I rant and rave about healthy lifestyle because that's kind of my gig. And I'm on the board of the American College of Sports Medicine, so I'm a practicing athlete. I'm out there eating clean. I'm exercising. I'm doing my gig. I'm walking the talk. Am I walking the talk with friendship? That's the question. Am I walking the talk with friendship? So all this other stuff is all fine and dandy, and thank you very much. But friendship is a monster, and people don't fully realize that. I think they blow it off a lot. And, oh, they'll always be there. Meanwhile, you don't know what's going on with that individual. You have no idea what they're struggling with or, you know, and you tap in. And to your point, what if they are struggling? I always go back to the old marital vows, you know, through whether it's good or bad, you know, for better or for worse. Well, honey, sometimes worse happens. It could be a breast cancer diagnosis, in which case, you know, if one of my BFFs wanted me, I'm on the next plane. I'm going to prioritize because guess what? What if it's me? What would I want? And I would want that support. To your point, and I'm so happy you're such an ambassador for friendship. This is huge. I think every day you need to be able to put down on your calendar just even the smallest little thing. How long would it take you? I mean, a freaking text, you know, like 1 minute, for God's sake. When someone gets something like that, you don't know if it's lighting up their day. What do you think?
Yeah, so there's some interesting studies that have been done recently. One of my favorites actually looked at whether or not people were reluctant to text a friend. Why were the barriers against reaching out to them in that way? And people tend to overestimate the degree to which that a friend won't like it or won't appreciate it or won't enjoy it. And what I thought was pretty cool about the study is a series of different ways to approach the same question. They actually asked the person who received the text, like, how did you feel about getting one? And they were like, oh, this is great. Like, I didn't expect to be reached out to by this person I hadn't seen for a long time or hadn't kept in touch with. And I think people perceive the barriers of time or distance to really say, well, I can't do that, right? I don't want to oblige them or I don't want them not to respond. So one of the things I encourage people to do is if they do choose to take those actions of reaching out to old friends or rekindling or reconnecting, don't do it with the expectation that this is going to magically create a new relationship or it's going to renew the friendship immediately. Do it because that it's important to you to have that person know that they're part of your memories and your life and your personhood, who you've become in your life. And don't do so because it's only self-interested. So what's interesting about those, though, is they can open up opportunities for reaching out, right? I was actually, while I was at Harvard over the course of the year, I reached out to people who I hadn't seen in probably 20 years who were living in the area. And I'm like, hey, I'd like to see you. So I got to learn about their families and meet their kids and, you know, learn what was going on in their lives. And I loved it. I had such a great time just catching up with old friends. And the truth is, we probably won't see each other again for years and years because I live in Kansas and they live in Boston. So it's hard to do that. But it doesn't mean it wasn't worthwhile. So I think what's important about this is to keep in mind that making kind of a dedicated effort to continue to keep in touch with your friends has really wonderful outcomes, but you can't approach it with the expectation that it's immediately going to snap your fingers and you're magically back in friendship again. Because the truth is life makes it really hard to be in friendship. It makes it really hard to prioritize friendship. And so as a consequence, we have to push back against life a little bit, but not expect life itself to change.
Yeah, I just don't want people to think out there, you know, when I'm saying like I have a little something on my calendar to remind me and whatever, it's like, oh, another obligation is like go to the gym, text Marianne, you know, that kind of thing. No, it's joyful, actually. It's really cool. There's also something else. I did something the other day on WhatsApp. I reached out across the globe to friends in Israel who I've worked with in the past. It's kind of their Silicon Valley in Tel Aviv. And I said, I just want to reach out and say, hey, I mean, you must be really challenged right now. And I just, wow, I just want you to know I really care. And do you know, I got a response back like in freaking 15 minutes, you know, I'm thinking, you know, across the globe. I don't even remember what time it was, you know, when I sent it. And it was like, oh my God, thank you. Because sometimes we feel so alone. And this is from someone who's got a big family and whatever, and a very successful tech person. So the friendship thing is another layer unpacking this thing. We don't have a white picket fence around this country. This is a global phenomenon. People move all over the place. I'm dealing with people in the UK, you know, in France and all the way through. So we have kind of, as it were, global friendships, which definitely makes getting together and just hanging out at a cafe a heck of a lot more of a challenge. Yet it's so rich. I just reached out to one of my friends in France, who is a big time venture capital guy who I've worked with, and he's just phenomenal. I love him. And I said, my God, what just happened with Macron? Just, you guys have another vote? I've lost count. And what's going on there? And he said, you know, thank you for reaching out. Sometimes we wonder what other people are thinking, and I really appreciate your friendship. It means everything. And hope to see you in the U.S. He has several homes here as well. And there it was again. So it's a global thing too, right, Jeff?
Absolutely. So, one of the things about the range of relationships is that, you know, social and mobile media have created the possibility of maintaining weak tie relationships easier and more fluid than it has ever been before. You mentioned LinkedIn. The way it's currently being used and the way that people are construing it now is a very much a professional development and professional networking kind of platform. You know, Facebook for a long time actually occupied a very major role for Gen X and the millennial generation for maintaining old friendships and people that you knew from high school or other parts of your life. And people are now turning to kind of smaller social media platforms to do that. They're using sort of group chats and they're using WhatsApp. They're using these sort of smaller scale social media and social networking type opportunities to kind of keep in touch with people near.
Like Facebook, and you know, they have all those groups. But I've got a question for you, since this is the Her podcast, and as we're winding this thing up, you knew I was going to go to the gender specific place. So do women do it differently than men?
Do specifically social and mobile media differently?
Just friendships.
So among the things that we know about the way that women and men differ in terms of maintaining their friendships, one of the things that if we're thinking about the maintenance specifically processes is that women have often played the role of maintaining not only their friendships, but their broader family connections, you know, and what's called kinkeeping, which is a process in which that women take the dominant role and all that. Women tend to actually are more likely in heterosexual relationships to plan the social calendar of theirs and their partner in terms of having friends over or making friendship a priority. You know, women have really, for generations, embraced the role of being the sort of primary social maker, like the person who creates sociality or creates social opportunity in their relationships and their families. And so all of those things sort of translate to also in the ways in which that they're trying to maintain a lot of different friendships over a period of time and space. It doesn't mean that men don't prioritize friendships or want friendships or aren't close to friendships. All of those things are true. all of the gender differences, a lot of them don't actually occur because that men don't prioritize friendships or don't think that they're important or don't get something out of them. It tends to be much more in the acts of maintenance and in communication, like the self-disclosure parts. And that's where the differences between men and women tend to come up. But I like to sort of reinforce the idea is like we can actually play a role in our partners and otherwise of being maintaining friendships. You know, so when my wife actually during the pandemic started working from home, we both did. And then the University of Kansas, we were supposed to go back to work in person pretty quick. And I tended to say, okay, well, you continue to work at home so you can have that space. And then I'll go into work so we can both continue to work. She's also a faculty member here at KU. And over the years that she would actually continue to work from home, she found it more and more kind of disorienting in the sense you didn't see people very often. She didn't interact as much as she used to because she was continuing to work from home. And she and I have both kind of have been really encouraging of like, she's like, hey, I'm going to have coffee with a friend today. I'm like, that's awesome. You do that. If I need to pick up the kids or I need to pick up some slack to make sure you have time with your friends, do it. You know, if she's in the process of doing, you know, different activities or meeting up with her friends after work, I'm always backing her up. Because I know that because of the work conditions that she's in, she needs some support from my end to help her continue to maintain her friendships. And it goes the other way as well. She absolutely backs me up when I go spend time with my friends or make time to have phone calls with my friends. So the kind of thing that I'd point out is that not only are there gender differences, but there are also ways in which that within, you know, relationships that are, you know, heterosexual relationships, we can support and encourage one another to have friendships and maintain those friendships. And in doing so, we are happier. So one of the research studies on this finds that when we have partners who are maintaining their friendships and tend to be more social, we actually also benefit. So there's, if you want to do it just for self-interest, there's that research. But if you want to do it because you want to promote your partner's well-being and their health and the longevity, do it for them too.
I love that. You know, I'm just thinking the other day where we've just become acquainted with a new couple and they suggested dinner and my husband immediately turns to me and going, okay, Pam will arrange it. Okay, well, wait a minute. But, you know, I get it. I'm totally cool and I accept my responsibilities. Now, for the last question is this. This is kind of interesting. Is it a generational gig? If you look at Alpha Generation right now and then Gen Z right after it or right before it, I guess, and then you look at Boomers or Gen X, are they looking at it differently? I can imagine Boomers really kind of get that whole friend thing a little differently. They were not weaned on social media. So by definition, they were more dependent upon hanging out versus Gen Alpha, which is a whole different world, and Gen Z. I don't know. Am I overreading that or is that truly a difference?
What's very difficult to tell is that stage of life co-occurs with cohort. And what I mean by that is that it tends to be the case that no matter what the cohort is, Gen Z, Gen X, millennials, whatever, at a certain period of your life, people tend to have a very developmentally similar trajectory. And so what I'm saying by that is that between the ages of 15 and 25, everybody prioritizes friendship more so than they're ever going to be in their life. There's some amazing research in terms of size of your social network and the frequency of interacting with friends. It's like basically the peak happens in your late 20s, and for the rest of your life, there's a steady decline in the amount of times you're having with your friends, a number of friends that you would count as friends. So there is a very much a lifetime development factor in whether or not you're prioritizing friendship. As you said, when people tend to actually reach retirement age and their obligations to their own children have changed, their obligations to perhaps their family, their parents have already passed on, there's also an opportunity for a renewal of friendship and a time with friends, which I think is really super healthy and super important about, you know, being able to have a healthy retirement or period past work. So I think that those things you have to kind of keep in mind. There's always sort of things that will happen at the same time. What we don't know about millennial or Gen Z is that they haven't aged past the age that they're at. So we don't know if the long-term effects of the fact that social media is such an important part of their lives will affect them over time. But I can say that the research generally supports the concept that they're using social and mobile media to communicate with their friends. Like they are using it for entertainment purposes. They are using it to learn. They are using it to get information about everything from politics to entertainment and music. But they're also using it for the sake of talking to their friends and sending silly memes and sending snaps and doing all those things. So in some sense, has the centrality of mobile and social media been stronger for these generations? Absolutely. Do I think that that's negatively influenced or might negatively influence their development over the long term? I think the jury's still out. And I'm just not as generationally skeptic as a lot of people who are like, oh, they're doomed and they're an anxious generation and it's all bad news. I just don't see the evidence for that.
Yeah, that's the Haidt work that we've read. Yeah, from Dr. Haidt, who is a researcher in that field. And he really sees more doom and gloom with kids, you know, with their faces implanted into whatever kind of device and absorbed and scoped out by every single social medium. There had to be a little bit more to it than that. I couldn't really blow it all off, which is kind of interesting. So as we conclude here, God, this has just been fantastic. I just know the Herd podcast listeners are just taking notes right and left. That being said, give us a teaser about The Social Biome, which is your new book. And of course, we're going to have you back on the podcast because we want to tell everyone about it in January. But just give us some teasers, like what does social biome even mean?
Yeah, the social biome concept is that we are in an interdependent relationship with our social behaviors and relationships. We basically create the conditions of our sociality and we respond to them. As a consequence, we want to think of ourselves as constantly nourishing a healthier biome in which that we reside and live. In order to thrive and grow in this world, we have to kind of figure out the ways in which that we need to communicate and how we communicate and who we communicate and how, what means, what modality we use to communicate in order to build a more thriving existence. And so we really lean into this idea of trying to create a kind of obligation to one another. We talk about energy management and how we kind of build sort of hormesis and good social stress around our relationships. We talk about the difficulties of communicating perfectly, and instead we got to embrace the challenges and the messiness of communication rather than think it's going to be done perfectly. We acknowledge the fact that people are constrained by their social conditions, but also see ways of developing hope and nourishment and belongingness in our process of building our social biome around one another. So this is with my co-author, Andy Morella, and he and I came up with this idea of the social biome back in 2020. And so we've since been writing a book for about 2 years, and we cannot wait to share this research with the world.
I think it just couldn't come at a better time. I can't wait to see this and have you back on, to say the least. And a lot of you in the Herb podcast land may have heard that word biome in a lot of different references. For instance, the microbiome. And this is the gut microbiome, for instance, and all of us are buying those little probiotics and all the rest of it. And at the same time, the skin biome, there's even the connectome, which is the brain. And this is brilliant work done by MIT researchers who've done some of the most extraordinary imaging I've ever seen in my life in 3D of every single little neuron in the brain, which is just extraordinary. It's very colorful and very very easy to kind of, you know, grasp as best you can. But that's why I love the fact that you took it out of the, as it were, physical sense, and you brought it into the social ecosystem, which really needs to be talked about. When I'm talking about healthy lifestyle, you know, rattle, rattle about nutrition and physical activity and sleep, stress management, all of that. But at the same time, what about that social biome of yours? I can't wait to add this into everything else we're doing. So I think you've just done another marvelous contribution to this whole sector. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, listen, I could talk to you forever, and I'm going to get in trouble with my producers and everyone else. I'm getting red lights going, get off. What are you doing? This is amazing. And I know all of you out there in the Herb podcast land have so enjoyed this. What I can say is, it's been an incredible time. And really, honestly, thank you, Jeff, for coming on board the Herb podcast to share your marvelous research.
I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you.
And everyone, we've been talking to Dr. Jeffrey Hall, and he has a brand new book coming out in January. Look out for it. It's called The Social Biome. That's B-I-O-M-E. And I'll have him back on so we can really kind of dig into it. As you can see, we love to talk about friendships, we women. And this was just an extraordinarily wonderful show Oh my gosh. And I want to give another shout out to our sponsor, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. And remember the Her Life Stages products, the brand new award-winning products that basically follow a woman through her entire hormonal journey. Learn more about it at Solaray.com or run on over to your health food stores and learn more. Oh, this has been another amazing Her podcast. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, your host, and I want to thank you, every one of you, for listening in and being such an important part of our Her podcast community. Pop on over to drpeek.com to learn more about my work and social media. And join me every week for another Her podcast where you're going to hear from extraordinary, entertaining, and engaging thought leaders, just like Dr. Jeffrey Hall, as we share our wit and wisdom for you to enjoy. Thanks so much. And remember, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and seize the day. Have a great one.